Our Man in China, Episode 3, Touching Down in China. I landed in China fearless and with an open mind. Neither trepidation nor anxiety burdened me as I embarked upon my adventure to the most populated land on earth, one ruled with a communist grip. Throughout, there was a sense of rigid organisation and systematic oppression that sees all of its workers lined up and following orders, as if preparing for battle. You might expect this for guards, but I saw it with restaurant workers too. The sense of indoctrination runs deep. I worried not of harsh police sanctions or rumours that the death penalty involved being rounded up, thrown into the back of a death van, and simply put to eternal sleep by way of a lethal injection, legal since 1996. I do remember saying to myself, I shall respect all I meet and acknowledge the past dynasties, traditions, and all that has gone on before. At least that's what I told myself. I was housed at first with the shifty-looking headmaster, Martin, and another teacher, Kieran, who touched down on the same flight as me. As everyone else did in the city, we lived in a huge modern apartment tower some 30 floors in height. Buildings are not constructed, or rather labelled, with floors 4 and 14, both considered bad luck. 8 is considered lucky. My first impressions were formed in the town of Tongli, also in Jiangsu. As that old HSBC advert demonstrated, I experienced firsthand how fishermen tie the necks of cormorants so these long-necked birds catch fish without swallowing. I observed how the fishermen kept them in line, disciplining them with occasional backhanders using a lightweight cane. It's not wrong, I told myself, it's just another culture. Yet not even another culture, a civilization different to anything I was used to, a new world, or one-sixth of it at least. Before leaving Tongli, I was given a lecture by an elderly man, translated by his 15-year-old grandson, on the virtues of love. He told me courting women was quite different to what I experienced in the UK. A young lady is courted by a family friend or a fellow university student. Women are never harassed by a drunken man in a grotty local nightclub, like they often are elsewhere. For one, a respectable woman would never visit such establishments. There is an art to courtship, a beauty, and a once-in-a-lifetime experience. Love and monogamy are values held deep by women in China. Not the men, it seems, however. Where wives are as faithful as priests to their parishes, husbands have affairs. A divorced woman receives nothing in benefits in China, not even for the child, and another man doesn't want a shared lineage with a woman who already had one child with another man. Out of a fear of poverty, the wife endures the man's misdemeanors. After this lesson, it was on to my new home, Suzhou, just north of Shanghai. Suzhou, spelled S-U-Z-H-O-U, was the city I lived in and was just one city in Jiangsu, one of the 34 provinces found within China. Due to the extensive diversity of ethnography, language, geography, and size of these 34 regions, they could be different countries. I had expected Suzhou to be a small provincial town northwest of Shanghai. It was anything but. Instead, I discovered a huge industrial city where many global companies had manufacturing sites and university partnerships were in place with other cities internationally, including Liverpool. After a three-hour coach journey from Shanghai, I was thrown into a vast network of lakes and canals, explored by wooden gondolas, overhung by weeping willows, and with one of the best standards of living in China. A place once described by Marco Polo as the Venice of the East, and unlike what I expected, Suzhou is a water city and has an ever-growing population of 6 million, officially, although unofficial estimates put this closer to 12 million. Incredibly, it was just 1 million 10 years prior to the turn of the century. I found myself in SIP, Suzhou, Singapore Industrial Province, and the area had only recently celebrated 15 years of a joint collaboration between China and Singapore. As you might imagine, the district was particularly modern, and Suzhou as a whole was rapidly increasing in size and wealth. The construction of an underground train network system was underway and would later be completed by 2012. The overground, finally completed in 2011, reaches Shanghai in less than 20 minutes and travels at speeds of up to 200 kilometers an hour. The maglev, which connects the more recently built Pudong Airport to the rest of Shanghai, travels at a top speed of 431 kilometers an hour. Although I knew several expats who resided there, foreign tourism was not overly apparent during my stay. It is, however, a tourist attraction for the Chinese within China and many other Asians from across the continent. Laowais, or foreigners in the English language, were not uncommon in the bar I frequented, and there are a considerable number of German engineers as well as both teachers and students from across the Western world. Yet we Laowais were quite scarce in Suzhou, and as a result, we were treated with minor celebrity status. They would stare in wonder. Others would dare to greet us in broken English, and if I smiled back, they would turn a shade of red and writhe with embarrassment. On one occasion, one chap filmed me whilst his companion stroked my arms. Due to the lack of it in the country, body hair is highly desired, and on more than one occasion, I had my arm hairs plucked by random locals as I roamed around the city. A good luck token, I was told. I remember changing after a gym session and noting how hairless the men were. The juxtaposition of smooth, unfreckled skin was contrasted with a mass of pubic hair. Despite the odd hair plucked, I found the Chinese to be incredibly well-mannered and never once confrontational. Walking through the city centre and even back streets late at night in more unsavoury parts of town still offered warm receptions, at least to us as foreigners. They were pleasant enough. As local proverbs reveal, he who strikes the first blow admits he's lost the argument, and if you are patient in one moment of anger, you will escape 100 years of sorrow. Both proverbs demonstrate the relaxed and restrained attitude that is adopted, the very antithesis of what I escape from. In fighting, you bring great shame upon your family. I saw just one fight in 14 months. How did I get about? Well, I had anticipated being able to stroll from one district to another. Instead, I brought an e-bike to maneuver myself across this great city. An e-bike, or electric bike, is similar to a moped in size and appearance, with a top speed of roughly 30 miles an hour. Designated separate lanes exist on all roads designed to reduce the number of cars as well as avoiding huge traffic jams. The locals travel without helmets and often without lights at night, and although I often said I would do otherwise, I soon followed suit. The e-bike is so vital to the economy in China in more ways than one. The overall cost is very little, roughly 3,000 RMB, £300, and they can be charged from a mains overnight for next to nothing. They allow the locals to travel across what is a largely spread out area and save the hassle of travelling like sardines on the buses or forking out for a car. There is no annual charge or insurance to pay, and in 2006, when the government hinted that it would enforce a tax on bikes, the outcome was a mass boycott of purchases, which led to plummeting sales of the e-bike. The economy suffered dramatically and the government plans never went ahead. Without my e-bike, I would have been impaired greatly. The city stretches across hundreds of canals and several lakes across a landmass of 5,250 square miles. This mode of transport certainly made navigating those canals somewhat easier, and where I thought bicycles were everywhere in Cambridge, that pales in comparison to China. On one occasion, I recall helping a man who had fallen off his e-bike. I pushed his e-bike to the side of the road after helping him up, despite the protestations from my Western companions, who claimed that you shouldn't help anyone in this sort of scenario. Apparently, he might have been waiting for me to help him, only to later claim to the police that I myself had knocked him off, and he would seek financial compensation. It was, of course, natural instinct to lend a hand, and I felt disgusted by others who walked on by, leaving a man to lie there potentially seriously hurt. Fortunately, he regained consciousness soon after. On a separate occasion, I saw a man knocked to the ground by a car. Since I was some 100 metres away and with other people around, I entered the school and taught my class. It was some shock to come out 2 hours later and see the lifeless body still by the side of the road. Safety, unlike Tai Chi or noodles, is of very little importance to the Chinese. Seatbelts are fitted in cars but never used, and I saw dozens of road traffic accidents. Cars often veered out in front of each other, horns blazing constantly amid chaos everywhere. The driving too is of an appalling standard. The test for any learner is taken by way of an online examination, and, as with much of what goes on when one wants something in China, the practical is simply a backhander to the test instructor. Law enforcement is poor and not at all what I expected. The police are in abundance at all times, standing in huts at the end of major roads, but seldom appear to work. They socialise with each other, smoking Marlboro Reds, and ignore most of what goes on. Either that, or they are ignorant of it. On more than one occasion, a close friend of mine would smoke weed next to them. I surmised they were not used to the smell of marijuana and presumed it to be a rolled cigarette. For after all, drug trafficking of any kind of substance carries a very serious penalty, even death. And death, tragically, would come up on more than one occasion during my trip.